Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
But it has many important provisions. Equal protection of the law, protection of fundamental rights, free speech, free expression, free press, right against unreasonable search and seizure, right to a lawyer, right to fair criminal process. There are many in there. So it preserves democratic institutions, it preserves basic human rights, it divides power among three branches of government, legislature, Congress, executive, the president, and the judicial, the court, Supreme Court, and lower courts. It does that so no one will get too much power. The difference when you're interpreting a text, whether it's a statute or the Constitution, is a question of emphasis. All judges, I believe you'll find your judges in Holland or in France or in England, they all think about the same thing in the sense that they all think that there are six important tools that they use to interpret a text. What does it say? That's the first thing you look at. What does it say? If it says something about vegetables, that doesn't include rabbits. All right? So you're limited by text, but if it's a case in this court, it's very unlikely the text is clear. Otherwise, why have judges come to different conclusions? So there's the text. There is the history. Everyone thinks the history is relevant. I think the history is relevant. And you look at it. What is the history of this provision or this statute? Of course you look at that. Tradition. Habeas corpus is a word with some real tradition in American and English law and elsewhere. Of course you look at the traditions. Precedent. What did judges say in the past? We all try to follow precedent. But if precedent, history, and tradition, and text were clear enough, why do we have the case? I think also everyone will agree that we look to the purpose. What is the purpose of this provision? Why? Did someone write it? They had a reason and consequences. If you decide this way, how, in fact, will you further the purpose? Or wreck it. If you decide that way, what consequences will flow and how will they affect the purpose of this statute? Right. So everyone looks to those six things. History, text, precedent, tradition, purposes or values, and consequences. Some emphasize the first more, the history, the text. They emphasize it more. They think it's easier to rely on or to find. Others, like me, emphasize the latter two, purpose, value, consequence, those more. But it's a question of degree. Justice Scalia thought he hardly ever looked to purposes. We used to discuss this, and indeed publicly. And I'd say, but here are some cases where you did. He said, I don't mean completely. Of course not. In a famous case, which I was in dissent in, saying that the Second Amendment protected a right to maintain a gun in a home, he thought that the origin of the founders of the Constitution wrote the Second Amendment, which said you have a right to bear arms to protect that kind of thing. My side of it, the dissenters, read the same history, and we came to the opposite conclusion. We thought they were interested in protecting the rights of states to maintain militias. Right. And history doesn't, in my opinion, very often give us the answer. It does sometimes. But everybody will look at it in appropriate cases. So when you read the media, well, you're reading people who are mostly in politics, and what they're doing is they like to emphasize their differences. But really, there is much more similarity than people think.
Yeah, I hate to tell you, but you're wrong about the Constitution. It's not your fault. I mean, that thing is like 7 pages long. Who has time to read that? And there's like 24 amendments. But it's not your fault. Everyone is wrong about the Constitution. Think about this phrase, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. In 1987, the Hearst Corporation conducted a survey to mark the bicentennial of the US Constitution. Over 50% of survey participants thought that that phrase, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs, was part of the US Constitution. And this wasn't a one-off result. According to a 2002 Columbia Law School study, nearly two-thirds of persons polled thought that this phrase came from the Constitution or from one of the founding fathers. But this phrase does not appear in the Constitution. James Madison, the author of the Constitution, didn't say it either. So, who did? Well, this was written by none other than Karl Marx in 1875, and then parodied by George Orwell in Animal Farm. Marx wasn't the first person to articulate this idea. Scholars trace the concept to the New Testament, which states in part, "And distribution was made unto every man according as he had need." Now, the Soviet Union eventually incorporated the slogan into its Constitution as, quote, "from each according to his ability to each according to his work," but that has never appeared in the US Constitution. So you can imagine if Americans confuse the US Constitution with the Soviet Constitution, they're probably wrong about a whole bunch of other things. Let's talk about it. One thing that people get wrong all the time is thinking that the Constitution mandates that English is the official language of the United States. That same 1987 Hearst survey found that 64% of the people believed that the Constitution made English the official national language of America. But English as the official language has never been part of the Constitution. Although English was the dominant language at the time the Constitution was ratified, many other languages flourished as well. The most common languages included Dutch, French, German, and the many languages spoken by Native Americans. Enslaved people spoke African languages as well as made their own English-based Creole languages. And most of the founding fathers favored bilingual education. Thomas Jefferson spoke English, French, Italian, Latin, and he could also read Greek and Spanish. He hoped that America would establish colleges that would teach in French, Spanish, German, and other languages. Others, like Ben Franklin, saw it differently and said things that were incredibly offensive and Malthusian, saying, quote, "Those Germans who come hither are generally the most ignorant, stupid sort of their own nation. They will soon outnumber us, that all the advantages we have will not, in my opinion, be able to preserve our language, and even our government will become precarious." Luckily, he didn't win the day on that one. Now, states with large German populations disagreed with Ben Franklin, at least initially. In the 1800s, Pennsylvania and Ohio passed laws allowing German to be taught in public schools. Of course, however, Americans have consistently attempted to limit the speaking of other languages in this country. Politicians have tried to introduce a constitutional amendment making English the official language, which would force the government to stop providing bilingual services. So far, these efforts have failed. And while a constitutional amendment hasn't passed, Congress historically has passed all kinds of laws that would prevent people from speaking non-English languages. For example, in the 19th century, the government forced Native American children to attend missionary schools. In 1887, the Bureau of Indian Affairs decided that mission schools on reservations were required to provide all instruction in English. Children who used their own languages were bullied and beaten by the instructors. This, of course, led to immense language loss. And, of course, French was the dominant language in the Louisiana Territory for over 100 years. The first Louisiana constitutions made English and French the official dual languages of the state. But Louisiana was a melting pot for different ethnic groups, and eventually their dialects merged to produce what we call Louisiana French. But in 1921, Louisiana adopted a new state constitution which reversed the policy of bilingual rights. The state banned the teaching of French in all public schools, which highlights one of the differences between the U.S. federal constitution and individual state constitutions. But of course, these trends continue to this day. Representative Louis Gohmert introduced the English Language Unity Act of 2021, which would declare English as the, quote, "official language of the United States to establish a uniform English language rule for naturalization and to avoid misconstructions of the English language texts of the laws of the United States pursuant to Congress's power to provide for the general welfare of the United States and to establish uniform rule of naturalization under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution." Of course, the reason that Gohmert wanted to pass this law is because it's not in the Constitution at all. And Gohmert's bill was referred to committee where it died. But putting language aside, surely that old chestnut, no taxation without representation, found its way into the Constitution, right? Well, the popular history of the American Revolution goes something like this. The colonists got so fed up with King George III's high taxes that they chucked British tea into the Boston Harbor, decided Americans would henceforth become coffee drinkers, and wrote a constitution ensuring that no one would ever be taxed again without being adequately represented. Well, as a resident of the District of Columbia, I would have to take issue with this particular summary of American history. In the 1700s, the colonists objected to the Stamp Act and other similar laws that imposed taxes on them because they couldn't vote and didn't have representation in Parliament. And in response, the English came up with a theory of virtual representation, which meant that since Parliament existed, every British subject was represented, regardless of whether they could vote. Of course, the young American colonists didn't exactly take to this early version of Zoom meetings. After all the pontificating about taxes and voting and the subsequent War of Independence, perhaps the biggest surprise of all is that the taxation without representation didn't make it into the final cut of the Constitution. Though the colonists did try hard to work it into the founding documents. The Articles of Confederation incorporated a "we hate taxes" stance by denying the federal government the right to levy taxes at all. This sounded cool on paper, but was a really big mess in reality because the new government couldn't pay its war debts. It also couldn't raise enough money for an army or navy. The British occupied forts in the Great Lakes while also dumping its convicts into the colonies. And so for this and many other reasons, the Americans had to write a new governing document that eventually became the Constitution. And you had better well believe that it gave the federal government the right to levy taxes. The problem is they forgot to mention that in order to levy taxes, everyone needed to be adequately represented. The state and local authorities also got the power to levy taxes, but the end result is that the Constitution doesn't guarantee no taxation without representation. But the motto was still a rallying cry for the disenfranchised populations, especially in the nation's capital where I live, Washington, D.C., which is also the only geographical entity in the contiguous United States whose citizens must pay taxes and register for selective service without having political representation in Congress. Well, at least political representation that can actually do something. DC residents pay more taxes than residents in 22 states and pay more money per capita to the federal government than any actual state. Now, we are not the only ones. Who else pays taxes without representation? Well, undocumented immigrants pay about $7 billion a year in taxes. Inmates pay taxes, and so do formerly incarcerated people, even if their voting rights have not been restored. American children work and pay sales tax and income tax, but they lack the representation of a vote. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole bunch of taxation without representation in the United States. And that's probably because the Constitution doesn't guarantee that right. Americans hate taxes, but they love shopping, and a lot of people think that they have a right to enter a particular store, or at least they have a right to contract with other people, the freedom to contract. This guy believes he has a constitutional right to eat at the Trump Grill in New York City. But here the police officer contends that a reservation is not a constitutional right.
It's not a guarantee.
They can't revoke my reservation.
That's not a guarantee. That's not a constitutional right.
The protester is in fact wrong about his constitutional right to keep his dinner reservation, but this is an interesting question. Do people have a constitutional right to enter a store or a restaurant? The Constitution is often silent about most things, so it shouldn't be surprising that no one has an explicit reference to where people are allowed to be, but the 1980 U.S. Supreme Court case Pruneyard Shopping Center versus Robbins said that the Constitution does not give people an absolute right to enter and remain on private property, even if they intend to exercise their First Amendment right to free expression. So if this man wants to get into a restaurant to protest, he doesn't actually have a constitutional right to do so, despite the First Amendment. But what about if the city or state government has imposed a vaccination requirement to enter? Does that violate the Constitution? Well, so far the answer is no, because not all unequal treatment violates federal or state laws. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 explicitly prohibits restaurants from refusing service to customers based on race, color, religion, or national origin. A restaurant can't refuse service to black people, or white people, or Muslims, or atheists, for example, but when it comes to other classes of people, it's a complete toss-up. They can do what they want. Restaurants and business owners have argued that they have a religious right to refuse service to gay and transgender people because of the owner's religious beliefs. Now, the Supreme Court has yet to definitively settle that issue, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with the Supreme Court over the next few years on this particular issue. It's definitely going to come up. But when a local regulation prevents unvaccinated people from entering a restaurant, which is what happened with the situation in New York City, we're not talking about a protected or quasi-protected class of people based on their race, ethnicity, or gender. That means a lower standard of review, in other words, rational basis review, which basically no law ever fails. So the bottom line is that the Constitution is not going to protect your dinner reservation if there is a specific enforceable law that says you can't go inside. Then there is a phrase that I think everyone is familiar with, the idea that the criminal law presumes that you are innocent until proven guilty. Now, that idea that you are presumed innocent until proven guilty is one of the most significant principles in American law. The rights of criminal defendants are very much part of the Constitution. For example, the Fifth Amendment bars self-incrimination. Quote, no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. This is known as the right to remain silent. The Sixth Amendment requires that people be given a speedy and impartial jury trial, an attorney in criminal prosecutions, and establishes defendants' right to confront adverse witnesses. And the 14th Amendment provides for due process of law. However, the Constitution does not require that a state prove that someone committed a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And the Constitution doesn't say that you're innocent until proven guilty. Now, I'm not saying that the concept of innocent until proven guilty is not important, but the bigger point is that not all fundamental rights can be sourced directly to a line of text in the Constitution. Astute legal eagles probably already know that many of our important legal principles come from English common law. But the presumption of innocence has a more complicated origin story. It isn't found in any of the sources we traditionally cite for English common law, like the Magna Carta or the English Bill of Rights of 1689, or treatises by Coke and Blackstone. In fact, this presumption comes from Roman law and canon law, which form the common law of Europe. And eventually, this principle made its way into common law in a very roundabout way. In Coffin versus the United States, the Supreme Court held that the presumption of innocence was a bedrock concept in the American criminal justice system. Then Justice White credited this to an Irish jurist named Leonard McNally. McNally was known as a zealous advocate for Irish defendants who were accused of treason. And during McNally's lifetime, the British system required two witnesses to prove someone guilty of treason, unless the accused was Irish, in which case one witness was sufficient. After McNally's death, the English press found out that despite his years of advocacy for the presumption of Irish innocence, McNally was, in fact, a double agent. He represented Irish revolutionaries in court, but reported on their activities to prosecutors for at least 26 years. Despite McNally's dubious role as a double agent for the government, today the principle of innocent until proven guilty is fundamental to the criminal justice system in the United States, despite it having no reference whatsoever in the Constitution itself. Now, that's just the tip of the iceberg of things that you're wrong about the Constitution, but this video isn't over because there's another Legal Eagle video about even more things that you're wrong regarding the Constitution. Not you, obviously, but your friends, probably. Things like the filibuster and the separation of church and state. And this full-length companion video exists exclusively on Nebula because, sadly, if I put it on YouTube, it'd probably get demonetized and there's no way that you'd ever see it.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jackie, and I'm one of your TAs in the course. I hope you're enjoying the class so far, and I'm happy to be here to help those of you learn about America's unwritten Constitution. And for those of you who were with us for America's written Constitution, welcome back. Now that you've listened to the first few weeks of Professor Amar's lectures, you're probably starting to realize that many of the concepts that we've grown to find inherent in our Constitution, some of our individual rights, for instance, or the separation of powers between Congress and the President, they actually can't be found anywhere in the document. And what we've learned from that is that the Constitution can be interpreted in a number of different ways in addition to just reading the text of the document. And it's helpful to understand the different ways in which lawyers and judges and scholars derive meaning from the Constitution as we think about how to reach beyond the text in this part of the course. And that's why today I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the various methods of constitutional interpretation. Now, one prominent con law scholar at Columbia Law School named Philip Bobbitt calls these the modalities of constitutional interpretation. And if you Google his name or modalities, you'll be able to look at them yourself and study them a little more, but I just wanted to give you sort of a basic overview. So Bobbitt identifies six different modalities, and basically what he means is that there are six different ways of making a constitutional argument. The first is the most familiar to all of you, and that's an appeal to text. So you've seen this kind of argument being made already many times in this course. It's when a lawyer or a judge grounds his argument in the literal text or a clause of the Constitution. So a judge might say something like, "We know that Congress has the power to coin money because Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution explicitly says so." So you see, textual arguments are usually pretty clear and straightforward. But sometimes one isn't able to rely on a specific clause of the Constitution, even if she believes that the document implicitly grants some sort of power or right. And so in these cases, one might look to Bobbitt's second modality, which he calls constitutional structure. And this occurs when you're making an argument about a right or a power derived from the Constitution based on the relationship among the different parts of the document. So you might say something like, the framers decided to enumerate the powers of Congress first. They included Congress and not the executive in Article 1. And you might say that that means that they meant for the legislative branch to be more powerful or to be supreme over the executive. Or maybe you might say something like, the framers outlined the powers of Congress before they outlined restrictions on that power, and so that means they meant for the powers of Congress to be interpreted expansively rather than restrictively. And then third, you might also make a historical argument. This is the third of the six modalities. And you might try to do this when the text is there, but kind of ambiguous. So say the framers used a certain word in the Constitution, and you want to figure out what they meant when they used that word. Because maybe you're not sure, since the word today can be interpreted in many different ways. And so what you might do then is look back to the time that the framers wrote the clause and ask yourself, what did the word mean and how was it used at the time that it was written into the Constitution? And some people call this an original intent or an original meaning argument. And some of the justices on the Supreme Court are particularly fond of these, especially in the conservative wing of the nine justices. Or maybe, for instance, there's a lot of debate about how widely applicable the Second Amendment is. People ask, does it apply to all persons, or are only people in the military allowed to own a gun? And to understand how the framers meant for the Second Amendment to be applied, you might make some kind of historical argument. You might look back to how people thought about the right to bear arms in post-revolutionary America. And this is often considered, again, one of the most conservative of the modalities, because you're really tethered to what the words or concepts in the Constitution meant over 200 years ago. And now we'll turn to the fourth modality, which is that you could make what's called a prudential argument. And this basically means that you might evaluate or interpret the Constitution based on the practical considerations that are at issue. So you're really making an argument based on consequences. So you might say something like, what's going to happen to the relationship between Congress and the president if we grant the executive the power that he's asking for? Or what's going to happen if we, the court, declare that the right to marriage is present in the Constitution, even if the Constitution doesn't explicitly say that? Now, judges are very concerned about overreach, and so often they try to make their rulings and their opinions as conservative and as incremental as possible. And so the classic prudential argument would be something like the slippery slope argument. And maybe you've heard that term before if you've ever taken a course in law or constitutional decision making or anything like that. And it would go something like this. If we grant Congress this power, what other unenumerated powers are they going to be able to assert as a result? Or if we grant this right to the American people, what other individual rights can citizens then make a claim to? So basically, you're asking, what's going to happen if we take this argument to its logical extreme? And lawyers and judges are always thinking about the logical consequences of their arguments. So it's good to maybe get in the habit of doing that as you're learning in this course and as you watch the lectures. And then let's turn to the fifth modality, which is that you might make an argument appealing to what we call national character or ethos. And this modality is a little less clear-cut, but basically, what it means is that sometimes lawyers will make arguments because it just feels right based on the lived experiences of the American people. And you're familiar with this concept from the past few lectures that you've listened to, as Professor Marr outlines how American people actually developed a right to certain privileges or liberties that aren't necessarily listed in the Constitution. And you also see these arguments being made a lot in the death penalty context, for instance, when judges talk about something called evolving standards of decency. And really, the court has said that governments cannot execute minors, for instance, or people who hold a certain IQ, because based on evolving American understandings about punishment, to do so would be cruel and unusual. And so you see there's sort of an appeal to national character and ethos there, because basically you're making an argument based on the changing values of the American people. And last, and possibly the most important to judges and lawyers, you can make a doctrinal argument based on judicial precedent. So that's the sixth modality. Now, this means that you might say that based on the court's earlier rulings, they should decide a case in a certain way. And this is very important because judges are very loyal to existing precedent, and they're very reluctant to overturn the holdings or opinions of earlier judges. And so if you're going to make a constitutional argument, it will be much more compelling if you have some kind of precedent to rely on. If you can say, the court decided a similar case 50 years ago, and this is the ruling that they came out with, and as a result, that ruling should apply squarely to these facts or to this argument. But sometimes that precedent just doesn't exist, and that's where the other modalities sort of come to fit in. And so you'll start to see, I hope, as you continue with the course, that there are many different ways to make constitutional arguments. And these are just six of sort of the most significant ones, but there are certainly others. And you can use one or a combination of these modalities to make your case as you think about how to interpret the Constitution. And it will be helpful for you to sort of keep these modalities in mind as you proceed throughout this course. And as you read and you watch the lectures, ask yourself, what kind of constitutional argument is Professor Marr making? Is he appealing to history or to ethos or directly to the text itself? And ask yourself, too, which of these modalities do you find the strongest or the most persuasive? And if you start to internalize these methods of interpretation, then you're on track to start thinking like a lawyer or a law student. So thanks for watching and enjoy the rest of the class, and I'll see you soon.
What does democracy really mean? In its simplest form, it means rule by the people. But there are also several guiding principles that act as the foundation of a democracy. Fundamental freedoms. All people living in a democracy have guaranteed rights, such as freedom of opinion and expression, freedom of religion, and the right to gather with others in public or private. In Canada, our fundamental freedoms are protected by the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, part of Canada's Constitution. The Charter also guarantees equality rights. You may not be discriminated against because of race, religion, ethnicity, language, gender, or sexual orientation. Free and fair elections. Adult citizens have the opportunity to run for office and to vote in elections to choose their representatives. Elections are conducted regularly, in an honest manner, without influence or intimidation. In Canada, there must be elections to choose a federal government every 5 years or less. Accountability and transparency. Elected representatives are accountable for their actions. They must perform their duties according to the wishes of those they represent, not for themselves or other interests. In Canada, elected representatives participate in activities like question period to be held to account for their actions and respond to questions from the opposition parties. The press also holds our government to account and aims to keep citizens informed. The rule of law. Laws are enforced equally, fairly, and consistently, and no one is above the law. This means that everyone, including government officials, must obey the law. It also means that governments cannot punish people unless they have broken the law. All Canadians have a responsibility to respect the laws of the land, even if they disagree with them. And last, but certainly not least, citizen participation. Democracy demands citizen involvement. This includes participating in elections, being an informed citizen, debating issues, attending community meetings, paying taxes, serving on a jury, and protesting. All citizens in a democracy have a responsibility to uphold and support these principles, because without them, we are not a democracy.
Okay, so before we talk about what a constitution is, let's first explain why we need one. Let's start by looking at the fundamental things we all need as human beings. These are a voice in the decisions that affect our lives, material well-being, such as food, shelter, and education, security and protection from violence or discrimination, and recognition and respect as individuals and communities. To help meet these needs, people create governments and delegate powers to them to exercise for the common good of society. The problem, though, is that while governments need powers to perform their functions, history tells us again and again that power without limits can lead to corruption, dictatorship, and oppression. Free, fair, and regular elections might help ensure good government. They allow people to select who they want in power, and over time, to vote out those who perform badly. But we also need some basic rules to control how that power is used, so that those who win elections still have to respect your rights and promote your interests, rather than using power for their own benefit. Just as in a game of football, there have to be rules and a referee, so in a democracy, there must be rules by which all the players are bound. These rules are provided in a constitution. The constitution is a law, but it's not just an ordinary law. A constitution is a supreme law that establishes, organizes, and empowers the government and determines how other laws are made and implemented. It is also more difficult to change than ordinary laws, so that those in power cannot make up the rules as they go along. Football wouldn't be fair if the winning team could change the rules, and democracy isn't fair if those in power can just change the constitution according to their own whim. The constitution harnesses the energy and power of the state, ensuring that the people control the reins. This explains why when people are trying to establish a new, fairer society, one of the first things they do is write a new constitution. This is what Norway did in 1814, India in 1950, South Africa in 1996, and Colombia in 1991. Indeed, nearly all countries in the world have a constitution to establish rules for using power. On the other hand, we've seen that when a democratic government is illegally overthrown, one of the first things the coup leaders do is set their sights on destroying the constitution. They don't want any inconvenient limits on their ability to rule by force. So the constitution both organizes and constrains power. Now, how does it do that? Well, there are several ways. One way is to divide power between different political institutions. For example, sharing functions between a president and a prime minister. Or between two houses of a legislature. Or between different levels of government. The national level, the regional, state or provincial level, and the local level. A constitution defines the powers of these institutions and regulates the relationship between them. It also ensures that power is rotated. One year we may vote for one candidate or party, but after a few years, their time will be up and we will have the chance to choose someone else. This means that no one person, party, or institution can accumulate too much power or stay in power too long. It is important to maintain a strict separation between the political institutions on the one hand, such as the elected parliament and government, and on the other hand, the permanent neutral institutions of the state, such as the courts, the military, the police, and the civil service. Constitutions also constrain power by saying what governments must and must not do. For example, a set of constitutional rights may specify that you can't be tortured, that you can't be imprisoned without due cause, and that your freedom of expression can't be infringed. Other provisions may direct the government to provide for basic human needs, such as education, healthcare, sanitation, or housing. Constitutions don't only protect the majority. There may be special provisions for minorities and marginalized groups, for their security, their participation in government, and protections for their identity and culture. Most constitutions also have a nation-building function. They seek to embody national unity and to reflect and declare the identity of the nation and its people. The Constitution announces to citizens, to the government itself, and to the outside world what the nation is, what it stands for, where it has come from, and what its vision for the future might be. A good constitution is just one step along the road to a peaceful, prosperous, and democratic society, but it is a fundamental one. By setting down the rules by which the state should be governed, a good constitution helps to ensure that the democratic aspirations of a people become and remain a reality.
President Trump says he already has a shortlist, 25 names of potential Supreme Court nominees. We have a very excellent list of great talented, highly educated, highly intelligent, hopefully tremendous people. I think the list is very outstanding.
Now, this list includes judges who have been handpicked by a group of conservative lawyers called the Federalist Society. And to learn more about who that group is, we turn now to Amanda Hollis Brusky. She is a political scientist at Pomona College and author of the book Ideas with Consequences, The Federalist Society and the Conservative Counter-Revolution. Professor Hollis Brusky, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us. So the Federalist Society, as I just said, it's a group of conservative lawyers who want judges to interpret the law as it was written. Start by telling me, where did this group begin?
The Federalist Society grows up alongside the Reagan Revolution. You have a small group of law students at elite law schools who are conservative and libertarian leaning. They see that conservative ideas and ideology are politically ascendant, and yet in their elite law schools, they don't see those ideas represented in their curriculum. And so they decide that they need to found an organization, a club, that would bring conservative and libertarian voices, scholars, and perspectives into their law schools.
And interestingly, you write, one of their earliest faculty mentors that they brought in was Antonin Scalia.
A lot of Scalia's ideas and writing about originalism and original meaning became deeply ingrained into the kind of founding consciousness of the Federalist Society. And the organization really grew up as a organization that promoted Antonin Scalia's conservative judicial philosophy.
What is a constitutional crisis? Would you know it if we were in one? To understand if we are in one today, we have to look back at our history. But first, a definition. Constitutional crisis, noun. A problem or conflict in the function of a government that the political constitution or other fundamental governing law is perceived to be unable to resolve.
The term constitutional crisis gets thrown around a lot.
You called it a constitutional crisis.
Our nation faces a constitutional crisis.
But not always in the right way.
It's possible to use it so often and to cry wolf so often that people don't believe it when there may actually be a crisis.
Obviously, the Constitution sets out the rules for U.S. democracy. It guides every decision, vote, and law. And when it's working properly, the federal government should essentially look like this. But constitutional crises happen when the Constitution isn't performing its central functions. Basically, when the system itself seems to be broken in some fundamental way and can't handle the crisis.
Such that the Constitution is not accomplishing the goals it's supposed to accomplish of allowing us to make political decisions and implement them.
Princeton professor Keith Whittington is an expert on all this. Constitutional crises can be broken down into two main categories: crises of constitutional operation and of constitutional fidelity. An operational crisis means there's an issue with the Constitution itself.
And that can happen either because the Constitution is unclear. It could be because the constitutional rules actually conflict with one another, such we have these sort of irresolvable conflicts, even though everybody's behaving in the way that is constitutionally allowed.
According to Whittington, there are two different types of operational crises: formal and practical. A formal crisis is when everyone is following the rules, but there is so much disagreement on the end result that the government can't move forward. A practical operational crisis happens when some type of external pressure requires action, but the current constitutional system won't allow us to do anything. A fidelity crisis is when the Constitution requires something and we're just not willing to comply with it.
So from our perspective, that rule is just that we all agree is a real rule in the Constitution, and yet we also come to the conclusion we're just not willing to obey it.
Basically, an operational crisis is about the Constitution itself, while fidelity is about how the government interacts with the Constitution. But remember, just because something is unprecedented doesn't mean it's a constitutional crisis.
A state rep in Michigan, Matt Maddox, sparked a lot of controversy on social media with his remarks, "Free the 16 electors poolside party at his home." In an audio recording obtained by The Messenger, Maddox warned supporters that a civil war could erupt or that people would get shot if the government continued targeting conservatives. Listen,
love you all, and thank you for being here tonight and supporting us. It's been difficult for Michonne and I, and you know, I talked to Wes, and I said, Wes, you know, if the government continues to weaponize these departments against conservatives and the citizens that are then the taxpayers, you know, what's going to happen to this country? Does anyone have any idea if this doesn't stop?
We're going to take your building away from you and tear it down without your permission.
No, what's going to happen? No, what's going to happen before that? Yeah, the goal is communism, right? Or Marxism. The Democrats' dream, right? But what's going to happen before that? Someone's going to get so pissed off they're going to shoot someone. That's what's going to happen. Or we're going to have a civil war or some sort of revolution. That's where this is going. And when that happens, we're going to get squashed. The people here are going to be the first ones.
Okay. Come on in. Come on in. You're ready for your close-up, Michonne. You're being honored for being an elector, so give her a round of applause. Michonne rules. All right. Thank you, Michonne.
Electors here, but I didn't want to out them. They're just among the crowd, and I didn't know if they wanted to say anything, but it's really better for none of us to say anything.
Oh, wait,
which is hard, because I like to say shit.
They're dismantling the Trump campaign, one person at a time. Michonne's the person in Michigan. She's a target. Number two, they're going to cheat again. You guys know that, right?
Yes.
They're never going to stop cheating. And who agrees with me that they did cheat their ass off?
Yes.
Right? 100% everyone.
And what they're doing here, the things that the electors did were things that have been done before, okay? That's all I'm going to say. And they're trying to take away our right to appeal an election or to question election, okay? They want to make damn sure that anyone who questions the election or disputes the election in 2024 is threatened by what they're doing to our electors and other people throughout this nation, yeah, that you will not say anything. You are going to shut the F up, and you are going to walk into that gas chamber. That's what they want, okay, because that's what's coming.
First, though. Yeah. And so what we're going to do, speaking of dividing and conquering, what my goal is to get a resolution up to impeach Dana Nessel. Obviously committed corruption with this corrupt prosecution. The law is there. Now we need to get the Republicans on paper to sign the resolution to impeach Dana Nessel. We're 56-54, guys, but we have two state reps running for mayor. Westland and...
Against her.
Yes.
Not against me.
Westland and Warren, Weiss and Coleman.
Oh.
And both of them have a good chance. I don't want to candy cap it for him.
Coleman wants my vote. Let's just say that. Okay.
So we want you to vote for him. And anyway, so if both of those go, for 6 months, we're 54-54. And we have recalls that are going on in our state. If a few of these Democrats are recalled, it's even less than that. So don't lose heart. Don't think that all is lost. We're very close in the House of Representatives. We do have some work to do with trying to buck up some Republicans and trying to inject backbones up into them. But Matt and I will work on that if you just keep supporting us and keep praying for us and keep spreading the word and don't buy into the narrative.
So why is Matt Maddox so upset? Well, it's because the Attorney General, Dana Nessel, actually charged Maddox's wife, the former co-chair of the Michigan Republican Party, with falsely claiming they were duly elected electors for Donald Trump. That's why they're upset, y'all. Understand the thing here, Lauren, that people have to understand. These people have always threatened violence. They've always tried to attack people. That's what January 6th was about. They were saying, and before that, they're angry and all this. These people are wrong, and they're taking away our rights. No, y'all are just mad because y'all actually broke the law. And that's the deal. They don't believe in being held accountable, again, because their dear leader has never been held accountable. All of these people are taking their marching orders from him. And I'm going to tell you who I'm also going to blame here, Lauren. I'm going to blame the Mitch McConnells of the world who were gutless and afraid to impeach him, because had they had the guts to do it, they would have sent a signal to the rest of these yahoos that he is evil and has no place in our political society.
Yeah, Mitch McConnell had an opportunity to impeach him. Not only that, had they passed that impeachment vote, had he gone into his caucus and told them to vote for impeachment at that crucial moment, he would have been ineligible to run for president again. So the question of that would have been decided in that moment. I mean, everybody knows that the entire Trump MAGA movement is built on identity politics and anger, and with an underlying of if you don't do it our way, we're going to be violent. I mean, you know, they are basically the other part of this, though, is what Greg brought up, this virtual clavern concept, which is, of course, extremely accurate. Until we get these social media companies regulated and Section 230 dealt with, this is going to go on again and again and again, because as it stands now, these social media companies are not legally responsible for anything on their platforms that causes a problem or, in the case of, you know, January 6th, violence at the United States Capitol. And they're just not responsible for anything on the platform. And whether it's lying, whether it's disinformation, misinformation, defamation, they're responsible for absolutely nothing. And at this point in the game, we're now far down the line. We know what the connection is. We know why things are different. There are only two things that are different between this moment and, say, 20 years ago. One, we had a black president of the United States get elected in 2008. And the second thing is social media. So it allows these people to get this misinfo and disinfo out. And as you could hear on that audio by Dan Merica, you know, that audio is showing the people in the background believing that the election was stolen. Where did they get that from? Well, they got that from Trump lying over and over again, social media putting out that disinfo and misinfo, and absolutely nobody regulating that. So that is a disastrous combination, and that continues. And as you can hear, nobody's really doing anything about that. Nobody's even really talking about it at this point.
Well, see, here's the thing. I think that people really need to grasp, and the bottom line is this here, Greg, and we've talked about this ad nauseum. White nationalists and white supremacists, they are the backbone of the Republican Party. The reason they were afraid to, impeach Trump is because they were afraid of his followers who are their voters. And so they were like, oh, he's going to go away. Remember when Susan Collins say after the first impeachment, I think he's learned his lesson. No, I keep telling people there is no bottom for this man. It doesn't exist. And so the Republican Party chose to be in bed with him. They had no problem with him being in power. Privately, they trashed the man. They think he's an idiot. They think he's dumb, but they love power. And they, like I said on ABC this week, this was, I think it was February 2017. I said, they have allowed evil into their house and evil has now consumed them.
Yeah. I mean, that's the bottom line, Roland. I mean, there are a number of, I guess it's a fundamental conundrum we're faced with here. We keep talking about the rule of law. But the rule of law at critical moments, because, you know, African people have fought for our own liberation in this country, has helped us. But we perhaps need to understand that we're playing by two different sets of rules here. Fannie Willis, of course, has used RICO masterfully in this indictment of Trump with the grand jury. But let's not forget this. She kind of likes RICO. I was in class last night with my law students, and one of them brought up the fact that, you know, she went after Young Thug down there on a RICO case. And to echo what Lauren said, whether it was Nicole Hannah Jones or whoever said that they were black, it'd be different. Does anybody doubt that if Young Thug's fans had been threatening grand jurors, that somebody would have been locked up by now? But the whole idea, though, is that we think about the law as an absolute, and it is absolutely not an absolute. The political calculus that Candace is talking about, you know, in terms of what to do or not to do with Trump in a kind of delicate situation, is at play here. You know, there was an article in today's Financial Times that talks about this $400 billion in investments in clean tech because of the legislation that, of course, the Biden administration was able to pass through. 80% of the clean tech and semiconductor investments announced so far this year are in Republican districts. Now, what does that mean? That means that this white nationalist party gets the benefit of a federal government that's working for everybody. So when you say, and when we understand them to be power hungry, it's not just power hungry for benefits. They're getting the benefits. It's power hungry for little niggling reasons. Race is at play here. If the Democrats were in charge of all three branches of government, the Republicans would benefit. But it's not enough to benefit. It's not enough to be a citizen. They are white nationalists. And we have to understand that the rule of law is not going to save us. We keep saying, oh, well, they got to do this by the law. They got to do this by... Set the law aside. I'm very happy, for example, that this guy is talking like this. Matt Maddox, who, by the way, owns 81 bail bonds in Michigan, Michigan's largest bail agency. So, you know, he ain't never going to be against cash, no cash bail. Let them talk. They're using the First Amendment and trying to hide behind the First Amendment. What they're also doing, finally, is this. They are identifying the enemies of our common humanity. And you got to pick a side. It's just as simple as that. They're playing by a set of rules that we don't understand.
Well, the thing here, Ken, is that I think people need to really lock and load on is that these people have supporters who are in positions of power. There are sheriffs, there are police departments, there are lawmakers. They are allowing these things to happen. And so this isn't just, something small. No. They have people who are state senators, state representatives, governors who stand with them. These people, look, you have conspirators, co-conspirators of Donald Trump who are in Congress as we speak, who are chairing committees, Jim Jordan, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Paul Gosar, the list goes on and on and on. These people are still there. They have not been held accountable even by Jack Smith.
Not yet, but if you listen to that audio that you just played a little bit earlier, there was a point where that fake elector was given an opportunity to speak, and she said, you know what, as much as I always like to open my mouth, I'm not going to do it right now. Now, that gives me a little bit of hope because of the fact that she knows the harm and knows the trouble that she is in right now. Now, that's not to say that that carries on to everything and is a cure-all, but she got the message that what she was doing and did is wrong, or else she would have been running her mouth just like everybody else on the audio clip. It is coming, and that's one thing about the law. It may not be kind of carry out in a way that we all look at as fair and just, but you do have to be patient to see. For those people who haven't read the indictment, to look at all the people that you're talking about, the 16 people that were the fake electors, and then the 19 people who were part of what Fani indicted, those 19 people, it is very, very clear, and it tells a very, very specific story that involves not just Donald Trump, but this is why she is prosecuting them all at one time under the RICO Act. She wants to make sure that people understand the big picture. It's not about Donald Trump. And in order to see the big picture, you have to look at all of the people involved, and that's why she kind of conjoined everybody together. And one of those electors, like we heard in the audio, she got the message that her time might be up. Otherwise, I think, Roland, she would have been running her mouth just like everybody else on that audio tape. It's coming. Yep. It takes time.
Madam President, this past weekend is our annual reminder as a country of the courage and suffering and sacrifice and passion and love and energy that so many of our fellow Americans put into protecting our democracy. When in a democracy, one group of citizens can deliberately, purposefully make it more difficult for another group of citizens to vote, they have put a dagger into that democracy. We cannot let that happen. And I'm here today to focus in particular on one voting right that we have in this country, and that voting right is when you're voting, to know what the hell is going on around you in that election. To know who is saying what. to know who the players are around you. If we're supposed to sit here as Americans and just act like indolent consumers, passive in this democracy, that's not the way it's supposed to work. Citizenship is an office, and that office has duties. And the duties include being informed of what is going on around you. And what is stopping American citizens from knowing what is going on around them is the cascade, the torrent, the Nile River of dark money that has begun to flow into our democracy since Citizens United. It wasn't enough that the Republican members of the court let unlimited money flow. They then had to refuse to react when that unlimited dark money went underground, when it went dark, when it became anonymous. They've had chance after chance to fix it, and they have refused, and we are left with this mess. It matters that citizens know who's talking in a democracy. In my circuit, the First Circuit Court of Appeals, where Jack Reed and I have the honor occasionally to recommend nominees to the president, there's a judge who I believe is the dean of the First Circuit Court of Appeals named Bruce Elia. He's a Rhode Islander. He was a Reagan appointee. He's a Republican. He's a very distinguished judge. And he has said it is crucial that the electorate can understand who is speaking, and thus to give proper weight to different speakers and messages when deciding how to vote. That crucial right is denied to Americans wholesale because of an unprecedented dark money campaign of interference in our democracy. You see it whenever it's election season. You're watching a television show and suddenly your TV screen is occupied by an advertisement that tells you that somebody is a bum, that somebody is no good, that somebody is terrible, that smears them. And at the end it says, this advertisement was brought to you by Americans for Peace and Puppies and Prosperity, some completely imaginary group that was cooked up just to launch those advertisements. And whatever filth those advertisements contained is then disappeared with the end of that front group. It's the political equivalent of toilet paper. You flush it when you're done with the filth, and whoever is behind it keeps their hands clean. So we now have a tsunami of slime, as one writer put it, flowing through our country, and it is denying our citizens the most fundamental right they have when they vote, which is to know who the actors are and who is doing what to whom. Well, in this bill is the Disclose Act that would fix that. If you spend more than 10 grand in an election, you have to report it. And I don't care how many shell corporations and donors' trusts and phony 501c4s you line up to blockade your identity, our bill will get through it. It super drills through however many screens you put up, and the American public will at last, once again, know who's really talking to them in their elections. Dark money, Madam President, takes away voters' right to know who's talking to them and what's going on in their democracy. It is a fundamental right. And unfortunately, it doesn't end there, because the other rights that my colleagues have so eloquently talked about, to get to the ballot, to be treated fairly at the ballot, to not be harassed on the way to the ballot, to be able to get a ballot mailed to you, the Republican efforts around the country to attack those rights, to suppress votes those ways, you know how that's being done? It's being done with dark money. We know it because they've been caught. It's not a matter of debate or dispute. When these enterprises are set up to deprive what Reverend Warnock calls some people of their right to vote. And when the laws are done so that that is accomplished against particularly African-American voters with what one court called surgical precision, that is not happening at random. It is happening because enormous amounts of anonymous money are flowing into groups to make it happen. And I will close with two examples. One is called Heritage Action, which is the current state of the art on this is you set up a phony 501c3 and a phony 501c4, and they're a pair, and the money to the 501c3 is deductible, and the political dirty work is done by the 501c4, and Heritage Foundation, which we've all heard about, is the 501c3, and Heritage Action is its 501c4. And Heritage Action was recorded talking to its secret donors. And the person who was making the presentation to the secret donors in May of 2021 said, "We worked quietly with the legislatures. We got the best practices to them. We helped draft the bills. We made sure activists were calling the state legislators, getting support, showing up at their public hearings, giving testimony. In some cases, we actually drafted the bills for them." Or we have a sentinel. Think about that word for a minute. A sentinel on our behalf, give them the model legislation so it has that grassroots from the bottom up type of vibe. She said, and we did this with little fanfare. Honestly, nobody even noticed. My team looked at each other and were like, it can't be that easy. Well, the Disclose Act will stop it from being that easy to have an out-of-state dark money campaign take a state legislature and get them to pass voter suppression laws without the state legislators even know who is behind it. And that's on tape. I am not making this up. The other one that's always worth looking at are our friends at the Honest Elections Project, which actually doesn't exist. What exists is something called the 85 Fund. And the 85 Fund is allowed under Virginia law, Senator Kaine, to have a fictitious name and to operate as if it were operating under its fictitious name. And it has several. One is the Judicial Crisis Network, which we all know helped stock the court with right-wing judges. But another one is the Honest Elections Project. Honest Elections Project and Honest Elections Project Action are the pair that work on this. Money has poured into this effort, and the Honest Elections Project has been smack in the middle of it. In 2012, 77% of its money came through Donors Trust, which is a great identity laundering device for right-wing dark money. In 2013, 96%. In 2014, 88%. In 2015, 84%. In 2016, 82.6%. In 2017, 93%. In 2018, 88.8%. And in 2020, the year that the Honest Elections Project waged dark money voter suppression, the 85 Fund received over $45 million identity laundered through Donors Trust. And much of that money came from one single $19 million contribution. Somebody wrote a $19 million check to suppress votes. Folks, if we don't get to the bottom of this, we're going to have a real problem on our hands. And when we get to the bottom of this, the American public will be with us because they hate this stuff. You can be a Bernie bro or you can be a Tea Partier and you can disagree on everything and you agree that big dark money corruption has no place in American democracy. This is the issue where Senator McConnell's political minions met with the Koch brothers' political minions, and they did whatever minioning they do together. And their conversation got out to Jane Mayer, who wrote about it, and this was the issue that they said to each other, we can't dirty this up. No matter how hard we try to put a good spin on this, voters hate dark money corruption. Our voters hate it just as much as their voters. So this is our chance to fix this, to take out the dark money behind the voter suppression effort in all these states. This isn't happening, folks. It is being done. And we've got to pay attention to who is doing it. And when we do, we will restore that fundamental voting right of all Americans to know who is talking to them in their elections. To have ours be a democracy without masks, without subterfuge, and without dark money. I yield the floor.
Would my colleague yield just for a brief comment?
Gladly.
I just want to thank Senator Whitehouse. He has been a leader on this issue. That is, it doesn't get enough attention. It is very much part of our bill, the Freedom to Vote Act. It is universally or virtually universally supported, and it's one of the great scourges of our politics. If we don't move forward on these bills, we're not going to be able to do this because we will not get the kind of bipartisan cooperation we need on this horrible, horrible thing that I think all 50 of us agree should be changed.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no wars, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Brian Mary Deese. Oh, God, yeah. And welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. A warning to the future. Or what future do we see ourselves creating? Interestingly, I recorded two episodes in 2023 that dealt with the future. In fact, I recorded four episodes. I recorded two episodes that dealt with the cosmic verdict that I felt was at hand. The first one I recorded at the beginning of the year, 2023. The second one, upon listening to the other one, I didn't really like it, so I re-recorded it. In the autumn portion of 2023, and I never published either of them. I didn't like the first one. And the second one was decent, but I still didn't like it enough to post it. And then the other two literally had the word future in it. And I wasn't against either one of them. And I may still publish both of them sometime this year as Vault episodes. But my parents used to always tell me timing is everything. And those ones, the time to release them just wasn't last year. So why this one now? Because I have some thoughts. And it is now New Year's Eve. Today is December 31st, 2023. It's New Year's Eve. And as I'm looking into 2024, I am massively intrigued by these thoughts. Let's get into them. When we speak about the Constitution to a country or to a nation, those two things being very different when compared to each other. A nation is culturally and often genetically unified. A country is defined by geographical borders. Nonetheless, when we speak about the Constitution to a nation or country, we often restrict our comments to what is written on paper. But, and many of us know this, what is written is what is apparent. There is a more subtle constitution that creates the backbone to not only the institutions to the country or the nation, but also the culture to a country or a nation. And that constitution typically is intuited. It's not written. The importance of this secondary constitution can be seen throughout the history of humanity. Most civilizations, big or small, had unwritten constitutions. They had unwritten guidelines that the culture was based upon. In more contemporary times, since imperialism started, the reliance on this unwritten record was supposedly usurped and supplanted by the written constitution. Yet, it was understood by anybody interpreting any written constitution throughout the world that the written was subordinate to the unwritten. Law, as envisioned by European minds, is the mechanism which the written is twisted and contorted to fit the unwritten, or vice versa. What is often thought then as legal interpretation is in reality an attempt to take whatever legal framework or hardened legal explanation and contort it to the limitations of the unwritten law. The beauty of the unwritten law is in its mysterious nature to anyone who is outside those centers where that law is kept, often amongst the powerful. The problem with the unwritten law, with the unwritten constitution, is that it becomes abundantly clearer when you take a few seconds to think about what the wealthy are able to do and what the non-wealthy are not able to do. In the past, or even throughout the past 60 years, the United States has found itself increasingly in a constitutional crisis. That constitutional crisis is not limited to the interpretation of the written constitution, but the interpretation of the unwritten constitution. It speaks volumes, I believe. It speaks volumes that we are entering 2024. You will get this, obviously, in 2024. And 60 years ago, in 1963, Dr. King gave what many people consider his greatest speech. I am not among them who believe that. But for many white people, the greatest speech he ever gave was his I Have a Dream speech, though most of them don't listen to the beginning of it. They only listen to the majestic part towards the end. And even then, their interpretation is highly limited to what they would like America to be, and that vision which they desire, Dr. King talked about in his Massey lectures,
which allowed for white people to still do the things they wanted to do that were negative towards non-white people, to still reap the benefits from that negative action without any of the consequences. It says something, though, that this man, Dr. King, who is revered because of that one speech, not because of anything else he said, but because of that one speech and the fact that he said, practice nonviolence against those who would practice violence against you. Not saying he was right or wrong about that, but that is why he's revered. It is widely appreciated and understood that the high watermark in Dr. King's legacy within the white media and white institutions and societies was that speech. Within a year from that speech, Dr. King would be being questioned about his stances on riots, his stances on black people's own culpability in keeping themselves stagnant in growth in this country within 2 years. And by the way, within a year would have been 1964. 60 years later, that would be 2024. Within 2 years of his I Have a Dream speech, Dr. King would have been criticized for not standing up against rioters, not being more fundamentally against the call for black empowerment, the move towards black acculturation and black dignity and growth and worth and self-confidence. And within 3 years, Dr. King's approval among most white people would have fallen below half, even before he spoke up against the Vietnam War. 60 years later, from his I Have a Dream speech, as we are entering 60 years from what I consider his fall from white grace, the constitutional crises that Dr. King spoke about subtly and directly has come to full existence. It is possible, and I would even suggest likely, that by the 60th marking of Dr. King's Beyond Vietnam speech, that'll be in 2027, the constitutional crisis that has been put forward by neoconservative forces, many of which had their origins in the Klan-based Democratic Party of the 1950s and 1940s and early 1960s, by the 60th marking, April 4th, 2027, of that Dr. King speech, where he warned of spiritual death for the United States, it's likely that we will understand fully by that date what he meant. Because that was prophecy, if I ever heard one. We see the constitutional crises in multi-dimensions laid out before us. The inability and incapacity of the legislative branch to do the will of the average American worker, the average American citizen, who themselves are confused by an overabundance of information that is literally crafted and created to produce confusion and disempowerment. We see
from this disempowerment and confusion comes an inability to seek to imagine a better world. What leads most quickly to despair and emotional degradation is an inability to imagine a better world, to see how that better world is possible. We live now in an era where media is literally crafted, like Soul Asylum said way back in 1995, media is aimed at manufacturing misery. It makes misery. Frustrated Incorporated. And I know, I get it, that was a late attempt by Soul Asylum to capture the grunge movement as grunge was being phased out deliberately by the corporate media. It was too expressive, is what I'm saying. But that song, I only heard that song twice on the radio, and it's always stuck out to me. Mind you, I'm talking about a song that came out 30 years ago in under 2 years. But its statement is the truth. The rigid interpretation of the Constitution that most people have, whether written or unwritten, is based upon this media atmosphere that produces misery, that produces the incapacity to imagine a better future. I've made this statement here before, and I'll make it here again. I have mentioned to many of my conservative friends, if Dr. King was doing what Dr. King did in the 1960s, most of you, hell, even in the late 1950s, most of you would be against him. You cannot have a Dr. King who you follow and be so pessimistic about the future. The media is creating it, though. And we have become so anesthetized to it and so familiar with it that we don't call it out. In fact, we're now to a point in the history of this country where the misery-making media machine is not only seen as normal, but its instruments are utilized by people wanting and seeking glamour and wanting and seeking fame. They use those instruments, which hollows out the human spirit, hollows out the human soul, hollows out the human mind. They use those instruments to gain that fame and that glamour and that fortune. This is where we're at. This is where we are at. The constitutional crisis in this country is not simply political. It's not even simply cultural. It's futuristic. Every single concept that we might think of as being the underpinning column to the foundation of this country has been broken. And it's been broken by the people who claim the loudest that they are standing up for those underpinning columns. They have been broken by the people who are the most loudest in their
promotion of liberty, their promotion of freedom. Note, though, these people never define what either of these things mean. Same thing goes with justice. If you want an idea of what is contained in the invisible Constitution in the United States, you have to look at the portions in the Constitution that are not defined. What is liberty? What is justice? What are the articles associated with those concepts? What does general welfare mean? What does defense mean? These things are hidden away in the invisible, unwritten Constitution. To say nothing about the expansion of borders, to say nothing about the expansion of culture, to say nothing about the expansion of what we today call the administrative state, the creation of the bureaucracy, which we all rely on. What is the role of business in the society? That's in the unwritten. What is the role of corporations? What is the role of the government in relation to corporations? That is in the written. What is the role of the citizen and in voting? What are the duties of the representatives of the people? What is the duties of the senators? You ever wonder what a senator does? A senator has an entire state to look over. What is their role? What is the role of the governor in national unity? What is the role of the cabinet? All of this is in the unwritten Constitution. Now, not every single thing I'm mentioning. No, you have codes and what we today call job descriptions for some of that. But if you really want to appreciate what the country is about, you start reconstructing the unwritten Constitution. The cultural aspects of it are the most important. Within the unwritten Constitution is the underlying guiding myth. The points of emphasis from that myth. We talk about individuality a lot. Well, what does that mean? That's in there. What are the roles of the founding fathers and their papers? That should be in there. If it isn't, it should be. The unwritten Constitution grows as the country grows. If it was a true metaphysical unwritten Constitution, they would include the caste system. Every European society has one. They would include the class system and the importance of both. They would include the principles or the responsibilities of the elite. We might call them the protocols of the wealthy. And I know some of you just was like, wait a minute, are you talking about the protocols of Zion? No, I'm talking about the protocols of the wealthy. If it was a true metaphysical unwritten constitution, it would talk about the religion of the culture. And here I'm not just talking Christianity. There's a book that I found some couple of years back called Americanism, the Fourth Religion of the West, I think was the subtitle of it. And I found that book in another book. Can't remember what book that was in, but I found it nonetheless. The unwritten Constitution is the thing that gives rise and power and efficiency, to the written Constitution. Now, the unwritten does not have to stay unwritten. The unwritten can be written. And in fact, it should be written over time. But the unwritten Constitution is going to be drastically different than the written. In fact, it is from the unwritten that some of the most opaque and soul-shattering, mind-altering interpretations of this country has come from. People trying to access that unwritten Constitution. And when it happens, you could tell because of the relevancy and the continued relevancy of the works that were created from that access point. I like to often think that the Eurocentric Constitution was in the mind state of Orwell when he wrote 1984. I know Orwell wrote 1984 as a warning against socialism, but I actually don't believe that's the reason why he wrote the book. He couldn't write the type of book that he wrote and have it become a classic in the West if he had said what many of us understood he was saying, that this was indeed a story about Western democracies, not adopting socialism, but continuously going down the path of this doublespeak that they were going down. It wasn't about communism. It wasn't about socialism. It wasn't about leftism. It was about the authoritarian nature hidden in the capitalistic, Eurocentric model that Europe and its satellites, particularly the United States, utilized. He was warning against what that capitalist society could result in. And many people miss that. It wasn't about the left. It was about the capitalist conservatives and liberals. The people who were the enemies to those people, to those promoters of capitalism and authoritarianism, were the left. That was the hidden reality in that book. You see it again in one of his lesser talked about books. That is Animal Farm. One of the greatest books ever written that people seem to not want to talk about. Because when you talk about Animal Farm, you talk about a reality that we see in human nature to this very day. Animal Farm is what occurs when the smartest people in the room are so diabolically egocentric that they are okay with creating a system that promotes their power as long as they're the ones who are in power. Brilliant book. Brilliant, brilliant book. And I would suggest that if you're not going to read 1984 at the beginning of 2024, you should definitely read Animal Farm. Because it is stunning. In fact, I remember when I listened to it a couple of years ago when I was working this job. We were doing tons of overtime at the time. And I listened to it and I thought quickly, I'm like, man, this has to be where black people got the idea of pigs from, because pigs play a prominent role in Animal Farm. Pigs play a prominent role in Animal Farm. But I digress. The constitutional crisis that we are now facing is a stark one. Within the unwritten Constitution is two paths for this country. Two paths. One is Republicanist. The other one is democracist. We have been traveling at full tilt for the last 40 plus years down the Republicanist road. We had for a brief moment And I do mean a brief moment, the beginning of the Republic, directly after the Civil War, during Reconstruction for a brief moment, and then the New Deal years, and for about 30 years after that. We have been going down, we were going down the democracist path for those periods of time, but it was always interrupted for a republicanist path. The republicanist path is not democratic. It does not have within it the capacity to be democratic, and we need to understand this. The republicanist concept is authoritarianism. It is hierarchy. It is you better know your place. It is the powerful have the most power. It is the powerless has the least power. And if you ain't one of the powerful, then you are not one of the powerful. You ain't got no power. It is built on you being a consumer of whatever the powerful wants to give you. And if they don't want to give you anything, then you're just hungry. You ain't consuming nothing except each other. The powerful do not respect citizens in a republicanist society. The republicanist society has no citizens except the powerful. The powerful are the citizens. You are not. Sure, they may sprinkle some stuff over you to give you the appearance of being a citizen, but you're a consumer. That's it. And you are learning quickly what the difference between being a consumer and a citizen is. The democracist wrote, you are a citizen. You have the responsibilities of being a citizen, not a consumer, a citizen. And if you want to see the difference, if you want to see the difference, the people who have the authoritarian personality gene, which is significant, unfortunately, in the United States, they are consumers. They need somebody to fill themselves up with beliefs. They don't often think through what their beliefs are until it is too late. It is the devil pulling the wool over your eyes only to take the wool off after you've done what the devil wanted you to do. You are a consumer of these people's ambitions, and you make their ambitions come true, even if that ambition comes at a heavy cost to you. The citizen thinks through another person's ambition, thinks through what that person is telling them, thinks through what that person is asking them to do, and makes a decision based on the responsibility that citizen has to the society, to the country, to the longevity of generations. That is a citizen. I often like to think of the phrase citizen as being far more important than we give it credit in being. I won't say exactly 100% why right now, but I will say that we do not give we don't give credibility to the extent of what the word citizen actually means. And if we knew what it actually meant, and someday I will be discussing that on here, it would change our proximity to our actions within our society, our civilization, our country, in this world. Because you have two levels of citizenry. You have a citizen of your birth nation and country, and then you have citizenship of the world. This was something that became
popular during the 1960s, the idea of being a global citizen. The wealthy have taken the idea of being a global citizen and isolated it for themselves. They have created mechanisms in which they're the only ones who can and should ever be able to use that global citizenship for their benefit. In fact, if it's up to a lot of them, they want to be able to take that global citizenship for themselves and build a base on the moon where they can live away from us. The Constitution is in crisis, y'all. Not only just the Constitution in the United States, but the Constitution which comprises the Eurocentric hegemonic reality. We are in for a rocky, rocky decade. We are in for a very rocky decade. The generations know that there's a constitutional crisis. The generations know that what has been tolerated cannot be tolerated any longer. Yet, those generations who know that are coming into conflict with the generations who are prepared and desirous of enabling what has been before to continue again. We cannot forget that in the next 10 years, the ruling of this planet will transfer hands, at least when it comes to the United States. This is the point of biggest contention for me. Not because I don't believe that the millennials, Generation X, and Generation E can handle running the world. But it's contentious to me because it is clear to me that the silent generation and the baby boomer generation has worked very hard to stop any significant development within millennials, the latter Generation X, and Generation E, to stop us from being prepared to actually take the levers to manage and run this hegemon as it declines. They have taken the idea of individuality, which I mentioned in an older episode, comes from the job reality of the 1960s, where there was fewer jobs because there were so many babies born. They have taken the idea of that individuality and the competitiveness of that era, and they have utilized that spirit to not only get to know well the next generation, but also to hamper those next generations. They have clung to power so long, they have forgot to raise up a generation of people who are not only competent enough, but are well-schooled enough to manage the hegemonic order as it descends. As it descends. And that is why this is a contentious time period. At least I see it as a contentious time period. Because what the silent generation, which Biden is actually born into, and the baby boomer generation, which Trump is technically born into because it's after World War II, what they are trying to hand off to the next three generations is a complete mess. A complete mess with incomplete
instructions on not only how to manage the mess, but what the overall vision to the mess was supposed to be. I would suggest that you go back and you re-listen to my episode on generations, because those episodes really capture what I'm communicating here. As we push into, further into the latter portion of this decade, which should be about 2027, 2028, this contentiousness is going to be on full display. If we see, as I expect, some major surprises, at least in the Democratic column in 2024, in the national elections at the end of the year, 2024, that contentiousness is going to increase. If we see increased surprises politically towards the Democratic Party, I'm talking about positive, away from conservatism, which I expect to happen as we move further into a transitioning time period where power is moving from the older generation to these newer generations, you may even see the fabric of this country tugged apart. I need y'all to be ready for that. The Texas state apparatus, which has to do with the wealthy money in Texas, the oligarchy in Texas, has gerrymandered Texas so that all of the power is in the increasingly minority white population. And do not fail to understand how significant this statement is. The reason I'm using Texas here is because it is a clean snapshot of the contentiousness of this thinking, this older mindset that is being kicked to the curb by the newer generations. The minority white population in Texas, which, again, don't underestimate this statement. White people have been the majority in Texas for a shorter time period than Texas has actually been a nation unto itself or a state within the United States. They were able to count themselves as a majority for many of those years because they held the majority of the power in Texas. But don't kid yourself. Just as there are, quote, Midwestern states that showcased white people as the majority population during the territorial years of those soon-to-be states, white people weren't the majority in those areas back then. Native indigenous people were. But the native indigenous people and the black folks who lived out there were not seen as people. My point is this. The unwritten constitution, which Texas holds on to, is being challenged by the reality that they sought to cover up for probably a quarter of its existence. That deep within that unwritten constitution is a provision that says white people should rule everything in this nation. This is a nation for white people. This is the nation for the betterment of white people. Everyone hates, what is his name? Richard Spencer, I think is his name. But he said this. He said this back in 2017. He said it back then. He wasn't lying. Oh, he wasn't lying. He was telling the truth. This is in the unwritten constitution. This is a nation for white people. What this nation is coming up against is a broader constitution that is also unwritten. And that constitution is a humanitarian one. It's a global one that unifies all people, including the sane white ones. The reason also, and this is actually more important than the global one, the reason also that the Constitution is in crisis is because there's another provision that is unwritten by man, but is written by God, who must sign off on all unwritten constitutions. And that provision is that the cosmos has the final say, and that the demands and the changes that the cosmos seeks to impose onto this Constitution will be evident in the cultural unity within the generations that are created throughout the future existence of this country. God's will, in other words, for y'all Christians listening, will be the final word on what the Constitution means. And every generation shall have its ability to add or amend the Constitution, justified by the ultimate destiny of that country. The destiny of this country is liberty, justice, and freedom for all. The narrow view of freedom, liberty, and justice does not have standing in the overall view of the cosmos. The humanitarian ethic within freedom, liberty, and justice has standing within the cosmos. Understanding that reality will help you see why the Constitution is in crisis, and help you see why Texas is going to be blue by the end of this decade. And to counter that reality, because Texas is already trying to counter it, to counter that reality, Texas may literally try to secede from the Union, as might a couple of other southern states who see their populations shifting towards the Democratic Party. Why? Because just as Republicans like to say, Democratic policies have produced no good outcomes for black people within the inner cities, Republican policies have produced no good outcomes, even though many of these states have been Republican for, what, 40 plus years? Republican policies have produced no good outcomes for just about that 40-year period. The Constitution is now primed for cosmic restructuring. Understanding this is so important when you try to understand what's happening in the next several years. So I want to thank y'all for listening. Happy New Year. As I said before, I'm recording this on New Year's Eve, 2023. If you like the content that I'm throwing out here, and I know there's many of you who do, because I listen to people who let me know that they love the work, do me a favor, support me a little financially. CWB Podcast, PayPal, Cash App, $2, $4, $8, $10, $20, $30, $50, whatever you could do, it would be helpful. Big up to Dr. Over the Shaka, Black Power Media. Big up to all my people who are doing this work. Activist News Network. Big up to y'all. Christopher Titus, Armageddon Update. The Ranked Cast, Lewis Black. Bre-
Brad Cast, Nicole Sandler, Best of the Left Podcast, The Professional Left Podcast, coming to you live from the Cornfield Resistance. Big up to them. The best podcast you should be listening to. They're great. Keith Olbermann, Countdown with Keith Olbermann. Found an old batch of Countdown with Keith Olbermann's from 2008. And I was hoping it went into 2009 because I used to have like a couple hundred of those podcasts on a external hard drive that broke. I was so sad. I can't tell you how sad I was. I was so sad. Oh man, was I sad. But man, there's a lot that I could list and that I should list. Roland Martin, Black Star, love the work over there. Karen Hunter, In Class with Carr, Too Black. Y'all don't want to touch some of that. Just to my white friends, y'all want to back up a little bit from the In Class with Carr, because that is a black show. Okay, I need y'all to understand that. It's a black show. I know many of you think that you can handle blackness on the level, but many of y'all don't know blackness uncut. Many of you know blackness cut with something that helps it go down a little bit smoother. You don't know that blackness, when it's raw and uncut, straight into your vein, maybe even into your heart just can't handle it. So you might want to just back up a little bit from the In Class with Carr. It's going to shock the brain. So just a little bit, you know, listening to Lil Wayne or one of these other rappers that I don't have no clue who they are because they won't be around in 2 days. That don't make you ready for blackness. Okay, just trust me on that. Trust me. Really, trust me. Big up to all y'all though, man. Y'all know y'all doing y'all thing. I think that's it. If you want to get in contact with me, questions, comments, concerns, reach out to me. Radio4ALL.net. Radio4ALL.net. Hook me up. I'll see you. You know, if you want to reach out to me, you can also reach out to me at my new CWB podcast mail@gmail.com. CWB podcast mail@gmail.com. Send me a message there. Boom, I'll be there. Also look for me on WordPress, Class War Battlefield Podcast. You can also look for me on Facebook, Class War Battlefield Podcast on Facebook. Good luck finding me though, because I get the sense that Facebook is not necessarily directing people there. And I say that only because of some stuff that I've noticed with my analytics, but it's what it is. Again, I'm your brother Vladimir Diesel Gaia, and I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Thank you again to Jackson Brown, to Brandy, who heard Song the Definition. Is what I use at the beginning of the episodes. The definition. That's her. Also, Michael Jackson and Marvin Gaye, whose songs obviously I use for my intro. I'm your brother Vladimir Diesel, guys. Until the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are lights in the balance. There are Class War Battlefield Podcast, episode 2024.01.00, published on January 13th, 2024. The references included in this episode from August 21st, 2017, at the 1 minute 13 mark, Supreme Court Judge Stephen Breyer, the United States Constitution and six interpreting tools, from the Nexus Institute, found on YouTube. At the 5 minute 25 second mark, from May 13th, 2022, the Constitution doesn't say that, from Vivo Eagle, also found on YouTube. At the 17 minute 41 second mark, from November 10th, 2020, Modalities of Constitutional Interpretation, America's Unwritten Constitution, from Moira Louise, that can also be found on YouTube. At the 26 minute 18 second mark, from September 3rd, 2019, Democratic Principles, from the channel Civics, that channel can be found on YouTube. At the 28th minute and 53rd second, published on October 30th, 2014, the title is What is a Constitution? From International Idea. Idea is capitalized in the channel's title. That could obviously be found on YouTube. At the 35 minute and 2 second mark, from a June 28th, 2018 article, What is the Federalist Society and How Does It Affect Supreme Court Picks? That is from NPR. You can find the link to that article in the show notes. At the 36 minute and 55th second mark, published October 10th, 2019, title, What is a Constitutional Crisis? Would you know it if we were in one? This is from the Federalist Society. You can find that on YouTube. Quick note, the Federalist Society YouTube channel, while it has many great reference material, always remember, it is heavily slanted towards a libertarianist capitalist view. Continuing, at the 37th minute and 22nd mark, from the date May 17th, 2017, titled, What's a Real Constitutional Crisis? This comes from the Scripps News Service. You can find that on YouTube. At the 39th minute and 44 second mark, published on August 19th, 2023, Trumper spews threat of civil war, some sort of revolution, over fake elector charges. This is from Roland Martin Unfiltered or the Roland S. Martin YouTube channel. You can obviously find that on YouTube. At the 53rd minute and 59 second mark, published on January 19, 2022, Senator Whitehouse delivers floor remarks on dark money and the right to vote. This comes exclusively from Senator Whitehouse's YouTube channel. You can obviously find it on YouTube. And the actual episode begins at the 1 hour, 7 minute, and 2 second mark. Thank you all for listening today. See you on the next one.